Hey everybody, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jeff.
Hey Jeff.
It's great to be here. It really is an honor to be Oldie Pa, and I thought it would be offensive when I first heard it. I thought, should I be offended? I thought, no, that kind of feels good. I first got here when I was 17 years old, and it didn't stick. I had kind of an agenda as to why I got here. Excuse me. I started drinking at a really young age. I think I was around 6, and it was surrounded by a divorce and a bunch of trauma that happened. And that was a coping mechanism that I learned from my friend's older brother when I'd go spend the night with him. And prior to that, I was already dumping sugar down my throat and doing any other kind of thing I could do to try and later I learned change my chemistry, but that was the first time I really was like, oh, and I got sick the first night and I was still like, yeah, okay, this is good. And I couldn't wait to go back every weekend, and drink more. So, I got to experience the progression probably two or three times before I turned 17. And, it's really odd to think about that. You know, I lived in a lot of fantasy. I was also addicted to the TV. I loved watching TV and hiding out and watching TV anytime I could. Matter of fact, I used to find the dial on the radio that went all the way to TV so I could listen to TV when I couldn't watch it, you know. And as I grew up and as I drank and I was an invincible guy. You know, you give me a little bit of alcohol and there's nothing I can't do. And I fantasized that I was different types of people from the movies or from TV. You know, so I was James Bond breaking into the Coca-Cola plant in Houston and thinking I was riding conveyors and being cool with the music playing in my head, you know. And, just stupid, crazy stuff that could have gotten me in a lot of trouble. I overdosed when I was 14 or 15. And I had grown up in New Jersey, Princeton, New Jersey, and I was also part of an interracial family, and that was something that was really not known of or heard of at that time. I thought I was black in a white man's body. So living in New Jersey and growing up in this mixed family, that had a whole bunch of other stuff to it, and having a whole lot of trauma happening in my life, and I overdosed, and my mother sent me to Texas to live with my father the next morning or the next afternoon, and I wasn't allowed to say goodbye to anybody. So later I found out my sisters and my brother were upstairs, but that's it, and they weren't allowed to know where I was going, and I wasn't allowed to talk to anybody, no friends, no nothing. Well, back then, you know, we didn't have these cell phones, right? So it wasn't like I was going to just start calling people. And if I tried doing that when I got to Houston, they'd know that I was calling people. And it was the first time that I got to experience the progression, really. I had actually tried quitting a couple of times. We used to sneak out in the middle of the night, and a friend of mine dragged me home by my feet. You know, it's easier to hook your feet this way, you know. So I was on my belly, and he dragged me a couple miles home from the university, and the next day I thought maybe it'd be a good idea if I didn't do that anymore. That only lasted like a week, but so I had a few things like that happen where I'm like, wow, I shouldn't do this. This might be a problem. Just crazy, stupid stuff. But when I moved to Houston, I thought now I have a something to do different. And for me, recovery has been the same thing that drinking was, in some way. Because I was trying to fix all this stuff that happened. I was trying to, like, some of the stuff that happened with me as a kid, I felt was potentially really damaging and had these crazy effects that I'd be out of control of. And I was going to prove none of it ever happened. It may have happened, and I was good with talking about it, but I was damn sure going to prove that it didn't hurt me. And that I wasn't. I wasn't affected. Drinking helped me do that. So, drinking and doing everything else helped me for quite a while. And when I moved to Texas to be with my dad, I was going to be my dad's son. And that lasted 3 to 6 months as I started drinking. Then I wasn't going to drink at the ranch. Then I wasn't going to do drugs. Then I wasn't going to, 17 years old, I had a DUI, 0.40. And I was on my way into the military, and they said they wouldn't take me anymore. And I dropped out of school. And I got sober, went to something called PDAP, you know, which was a big thing in Houston. And that was kind of a funny thing. It was also a place to hook up, but and tried going to meetings, and everybody was a lot older. There wasn't really young people in my circle. The ones who weren't that serious. They were forced there, and so it just was what it was. But I got serious about it, and I decided not to drink anymore. Although I drank like a case of Pepsi and 2 packs of cigarettes a day, you know, like. Whatever. I wasn't doing that. Like, wow. but anyway, so that was it. I went in the Marine Corps with 6 months sober. Of course, that gave me 9 months when I got out, and went out to dinner with my dad and my stepmom, and thought I was a man now and could drink, and had some wine. And the amount of energy it took to leave something in the glass was huge, right? So that was my story. That lasted another 2.5 years till I got sober in the Marine Corps after some other major crazy stuff I did. Thinking that I was playing some other role from some other world on TV that doesn't exist. And I got in a lot of trouble and thought I was facing Leavenworth and got put on restriction. And I was basically given up on by my unit. And I was sleeping underneath the rack every day, drinking as much as I could. And something changed. It was like and I'm forever grateful for it. To this day, I still don't know what happened. I was forced to stop drinking because I had to go to a class. And I got a letter from my father that he wrote to me and my sister from what he thought might be his deathbed, and my life changed forever. And for some reason, I've never drank again. That was January 11th of 1986. So, recovery, right? I find these steps, I find these people. I was pretty out of it, I was pretty foggy. My drill instructor, the guy who ran the meetings, that was in Okinawa, was a master gunnery sergeant, and he was everyone's sponsor, right? Highest ranking members, everyone's sponsor. And I was basically told to sit down and sit on my hands in not so nice a manner. That was my major instruction, sit on your hands and don't drink. Try drinking while you're sitting on your hands. And that worked, it kept me going to meetings. And it worked later in recovery when I was just itchy, wanting to create drama, wanting to create chaos, wanting to do something different. But I made it through that first year with a lot of changes because I got out of the military in that first year. I moved to San Francisco where I met Kelly and started chasing her because that could be my next fix, right? We could fix everything that ever happened to either one of us by having this amazing life in recovery. And these steps apply to so many things in our lives that I was so unaware of. You know, at the time, number one way you could bet that I would never call you again is to become my sponsor. That happened for about 2-3 years, right? Hey, will you be my sponsor? Awesome. All of a sudden, I can't pick up the phone to talk to that person. I'm talking to everyone else except for that person. So I was stubborn. I went through a lot of stuff, but I started going through the steps. And I had gone through the steps with my master gunnery sergeants because they just told me what to do, right? And when I got to Northern California and we were doing that it wasn't the same. Cool. So I don't know, life has been wild. It's been like nothing I'd ever imagine. I've been able to be a husband, a dad. I remember the shift for anyone here that is going through anything like that or experiencing that or has experienced it. I remember there was a shift in recovery where I have a wife and I have daughters and I have a car and I have a house and I have whatever. I remember the shift when I get to be a dad. I get to be a husband. I get to drive a car. You know, I have a car you can throw up in today. that was a huge shift, right? Where I had gone through the steps again, I'd seen some other defects of character, I saw another layer of the selfishness and self-centered that we all experience. And I had people love me instead of criticize and ridicule. And I got to see it, and I got to change. So epiphanies like that happen more in recovery than anything I've ever known. Recovery is really all I know at this point. And I'm extremely grateful for it. So I hope that that gives someone hope. And I'm gonna pass.
Awesome. Can we give them all another round of applause, please? All right, so we actually shortened up the panel because they are gracious enough because they want to get some questions in. And so if anybody has any questions, we'll just take them one by one. And you guys are going to have to, whoever wants to answer has to come back up because of the recording. First question? Okay, so the question was, did you guys struggle having time and being young and their peers as well? It's a very long question.
Jeff, alcoholic. Hey, Jeff. I just decided to stand up because I struggle with almost anything. that tight grip, right? I struggled with time in general. I struggled with all the ideas that went through my head that maybe I was just young, maybe I was just something else. And everyone had an answer, and it wasn't always the same as mine, and I had a problem with that too. I got introduced to our sister fellowship pretty early because if I was sponsoring you and you didn't do what I said, I had a real problem with that, right? That was a struggle, you know? So I got to go to family groups as well and start learning about what that looked like. I struggled a lot. And now what I did about it was constant self-talk. I used affirmations. I used an entirely new type of self-talk. I actually worked through trying to strategize. Something happened for me along the way, too, where I started noticing things that were kind of good about me, which was hard. And I started noticing some of my skills and some of my ability to do things well, and I started applying those towards those thoughts and towards those ideas and towards my relationship to others. And I started trying to really maximize things that were good about me instead of constantly turning myself down and beating myself up. You know, and I started finding more grace and acceptance. And I used to get mad about acceptance, man. Old guys like me would stand there and talk about acceptance is the key to all your problems. And I'd be like, yeah, you're old and you have nothing left to do. Like, you can just sit there and be like, it's all good now. You know, I'm like, no. Like, I got stuff to do, right? And there were other problems socially, right? Trying to learn, what are our morals? What are our ethics? What do we, you know? Oh, my gosh, it was a problem. And do you really have time if you're doing that? You know, so there was some of that too. And it was like acceptance, learning to be okay with people. I will tell you one thing that happened, and I'll shut up. One thing I learned early is that the people I judged for the stuff that was happening, if I judged them, I'd experience it. I'd get hit in the face. I'd get to turn around and go, wow, I understand where they were coming from. And now I wish I didn't, because this is painful. And I get why they were whatever. I hope that answered your question.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay, I saw a hand over here.
Yeah, I'm John.
Hey, John.
Do you have any experience how you keep AA exciting into your 30s of years? If it is, maybe it always has been and always is, but if you had any times when it was like more drudgery or
Okay.
Comment on that.
Yeah, so the question is, how do you guys keep it exciting after 30 years of arduous AA?
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Kelly. That's a great question. I would love to tell you for 34 years I've done nothing but be excited about AA, but that's a lie. It just is. There was times I wasn't excited. I didn't want to go to meetings. I didn't want to be of service, and I wasn't, and I didn't. And what happened from that was that I was crazy. I didn't pick up, but my mind was... was not good. It was a danger zone for sure. Is it always exciting? Absolutely not. But my suggestion is that you get into a lot of service. I am the SRI Summer Roundup Chair, which is amazing. Like, I am one of those people that would take an F in class if I had to talk out loud to people because I was so withdrawn and so introverted. And now I'm the SRI chairperson, which is hugely an honor. But and from that, it's made AA so exciting. I've been on the committee for about 7 years now. And so my suggestion is definitely be in the middle. Whatever works for you, be in the middle of the herd. Because, you know, the saying is that if you're not in the middle, you get plucked off. And so it makes sobriety for me super exciting. And it's the greatest high I've ever had. So that's my suggestion. So thanks for asking.
Anyone else? Jenny Lee.
Jenny Lee, how old was Old Timer when you got sober?
Yeah. Okay, the question is, how old was Old Timer when you guys got sober?
In Indiana, it was 10 years.
10 years was 10 the old timers in Indiana? Okay. I don't know.
In the big book, they talk about substantial sobriety being 2.5 years.
Substantial sobriety being 2.5 years. I don't know how this recording thing works. Yes.
How about enlarging your spiritual life? What does that look like?
What does enlarging your spiritual life look like?
I'm Robin Alcoholic. For me, it starts with having accountability. Okay, not only spiritual accountability, but earthly accountability. So like I said, I alluded to before, I'm part of a tribe. Kelly and I started this Facebook thing 6 years ago or whatever, 4 years ago, and it's our lineage. So every morning there's 60 people that are getting recovery blast that come up, or they post blast, just reminding us about staying spiritually connected, okay? Being very intentional. The other thing about our tribe is that we do events, we do activities together with our partners so that we can go have fun in the fellowship, okay? Recovery is about not being a glum lot today. Improving the spiritual ten, expanding that for me is also being intentional with my prayers, not only prayers for myself, but prayers for others. I have a lot of people that provide me spiritual guidance, not only about 12 steps, but about application of those 12 steps, 12 concepts, 12 traditions. Not Robin's interpretation, but what God's will is for me. And then going back to that thing again, the first step, getting out of me and becoming more of we.
Yes.
Leah Alcoholic,
Hallelujah.
This is for Jeff more than anything. You mentioned that at one point you came to a get-to point in your sobriety where you looked at things like your house and your kids and all that stuff differently. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, like what that looked like and how much sobriety you had at that time?
So you're just asking to elaborate on the get-tos of and what time and... Okay.
This is going to kind of answer two questions. Talk about expanding our spiritual horizons. I am, or whatever your question was, and that. Somewhere around 12 years, I was really disgruntled with the fellowship I was a part of. The isolated little group that I was a part of. I looked around the room, this is a true story, and I thought, and I was thinking about spiritual expansion, like how can I become a better person and how can I get a better, deeper, broader understanding of my higher power and how could all this happen? And I had learned the power of association, like that those that we hang out with is what we're going to do, which is powerful. And kind of like sticking with the winners, right? Like that had been delivered to me in a little different understanding. And I was looking around the room thinking, oh crap, this is my ceiling. Like everyone in here, if this is my only association, I'm not going to grow beyond what's right in this small room. And I kind of freaked out in here. And I started looking. Like I started realizing that it doesn't have to be just that one AA group, or it doesn't just have to be AA. And I started really getting a different picture of the 11th step. And I started thinking about, where do I come from? What's my history, like deeper than I did before? What did I believe? What was I taught as I grew up? And where can I go to find information about that? And I was no longer afraid to look at things that I had closed the door to because they had hurt me. And I started just saying, I'm open to anything. Like my open-mindedness and my willingness changed. And what happened is I started checking out different churches, different prayer groups, different things that were just available. Not because I wanted to become a part of that, but because I wanted to learn what it was and how I interacted with it so I could make better, deeper understanding and perspective of my higher power. And I realized that I didn't abandon the steps. I still had a sponsor. I did go to other AA meetings, and I started expanding that horizon as well. But one of the number one things that happened was that shift happened of realizing that there was still a layer of selfishness and self-centeredness that had existed for me and in my associations. Because gosh darn it, I'm sober, right? And I'm living a good life now, and I this and I that. And it wasn't fixing the whole world and it wasn't changing everything, but what I realized was that, wow, none of this is something. I don't own any of this. I don't own my children. I don't own my wife. I don't own my home, really. I got a mortgage on it, right? But no, it got to be, it really shifted that, oh, I get to experience all this stuff. And I you know, some of it too is I think I realized how I was treated as a kid growing up. And I started to realize too that I was a choice of how I treat others and how I perceive others. And it just became something I started really internalizing and using different words by choice to feel how that felt, which then became even more of a shift. Does that answer?
Thanks, Jeff.
Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you, Holly.
Hi, Nikki.
Thank you guys for your share. Rob and I really enjoy that you're like welcoming everybody, like even in the middle of your talk, because that's the kind of person I want to be. My question for you guys, because you got sober very young, have you ever had a sponsor that has had less years than yourself, and just kind of share on that, because I feel sometimes like I'm in that boat.
Okay, so the question is, have you guys ever had a sponsor that's had less time than you? And elaborate.
That's a great question. Yes, I have a sponsor that's is younger in sobriety than me. I have 34 years, she has 32, but she has what I want. She knows the book, like I've never seen anybody know the book. She leads workshops on big books. She's in one of our sister fellowships that helps me with some of my emotional sobriety. So I chose her about 6 years ago because I totally want what she has. It does not matter to me that she has less than I have, because it's really, we just have today. And there's moments my ego gets wrapped around my length of sobriety and I go, well, she has 2 years less than me. And I'm like, well, there's some ego. But yeah, she definitely has what I want, and I think that's the important tool. So yeah, she's just one of those women that she's older than me in age and in wisdom, and she knows that book like I've never seen anybody know that book. So does that answer your question at all? Okay. So for me, there's nowhere in the big book that it says your sponsor must have such amount of years more than you, or months or days. You know, I mean, really, the founders of our program had just a very short few months when they started sponsoring other people. So, you know, I don't know that it really matters. Just the person has what you want. So does that help? Okay.
Okay, so the question, I mean, I guess could be for all of you guys, but just about your family and whether it can be restored, and if it is restored, and the other fellowships and working that, I think.
I'll try and do this without too much emotion. Thinking about it, this is an ugly disease. I am so hurt right now and angry about this disease. My mother and my stepfather never bought into this too much. My stepmother and my father never bought into this too much. I lost my mother in April, having never really decided to join in the idea of recovery. And honestly, in 33 years of recovery, until the last 3 to 5 years, I was never safe for her because she was still attached to secrets. And I chose to maintain a relationship with her, which wasn't always great for my kids or for anyone else. See, there I go, my kids. I also lost my second wife to this disease. She's still alive somewhere, I think. Last time I saw her, she was homeless. She had some surgeries and got hooked on opiates. And after a 5-year separation, I finally just had to divorce. And she's such a different person. This is just ugly, man. Now, I've also had blessings. Like, I was the only one in my family for a really long time. And after 10, 12 years, my sister came around, my stepsister. And she ended up back out, but she's back now. And she lives near me. And we get to be friends. Now, there's a lot of old family crap because my stepdad's still alive. And they were estranged. And so that whole family's, you know, there's just dynamics in family. Well, they weren't estranged, but there was some distance in that for many years, and I had chosen to keep a long-term relationship with these guys. So there's just ugliness that happens in the separation of this sickness, and it's truly a family disease. So my only encouragement in that is that it's okay to aggressively approach this from any and every angle. You know, there's a lot of, my perspective and opinion is there's a lot of attitude about what fellowship and what program and what do we need and not need. And man, there's just, that doesn't need to be there. We can walk into any fellowship and talk about anything. I know people that, you know, have serious, you know, drug challenges. There's fellowships for that. There's places, there's readings for that. There's things to do about that. Same thing with family. Same, expand our horizons and be okay with it. This is where I'm at and what I do. I do some other fellowships too. For a while, I did a whole bunch of them. But I did end up in a handful of other fellowships around family and some of that stuff too. Now, I also sought outside help, and that might be worth just mentioning. that a lot of that had to do with seeking outside help, getting counseling, therapy, where I could address some of those deeper underlying issues that came up that weren't to be handled in the rooms, which is why I've talked more vaguely about some of that stuff. So,
And I just want to talk about the gift of recovery. This is first time in my life in 33 years sober where I have an opportunity to not only be on a panel, but to be of service with my partner and my partner's ex. That's a gift. That's a gift. You know, when I think about the love that we share, no matter where we're coming from or no matter what the history has been, because we all have history, that we put that aside and we float on love so that we can embrace the kids, the grandkid, you know, do family events. That's huge. And that was something that I had never been privy to before. Because for me, my family's crazy. My biological family's crazy. That's why I moved to Arizona, right? Leave them in Indiana with the Everclear. But, you know, for me, it's about looking at this as a gift. This is a gift that's not man-made. It's spirit-created.
Yes.
Frank Alcoholic.
Hi, Frank.
Thanks, guys. I love you all. You know, the Big Book tells us, and I actually believe in my heart, that we're not to live a life in a veil of tears, that we are convinced our Heavenly Father wants us to live a life happy, joyous, and free. And I live that, and I believe that, and I'm full of gratitude for that. How do you move past the fear that the gifts that you have,
okay, so question is, how do you move past your fear of your, you know, what's inside your brain, you know, and move forward and past that?
I guess I got the short stick on that one. Gee, thanks. For me, somebody posted something in the tribe the other day. It says, fear is the what ifs, and faith is even though. Or even when. So for me today, I have to look at, and I often ask myself and my sponsees, where are your feet at? I've got to stay in that moment. I can project, I'm the queen of projection, but I can tell you, just like with my Everclear rides, it doesn't come to be true, okay? So it's about what I'm doing today. And if I'm being intentional and manifesting the things that need to grow today, then they're growing. They're growing. I'm living on, floating on faith and love, and knowing that whatever happens today, my experience has shown me God gets me through it. God gets me through it. So if I show up available to my partner, whatever we might have going on that might be tension, we talk about it today. We have conversations, okay? I don't run. My pattern before was run. Look at me the wrong way, I'm gone. New zip code, here I come, right? Today, I don't have to do that. I don't work her program. She doesn't work my program. That's a gift. I have a sponsor. She's not it, right? So I stay stuck in my own stuff, be committed to working my stuff so that I'm available to love. And that's how it works for me. And not projecting, because projection is just, that's fear for me. So where are my feet? That's what I look at.
I just wanted to say one thing. I don't think there's a way to beat it. And I hear what you're saying, too. This is the human condition, right? So I just heard a ton of things in my head as she was sharing. And I'm clear about one thing, that gratitude is the enemy of evil, of fear, of all this stuff. Gratitude is absolutely what the only way I have found that I can counter any of this crazy stuff going on, and I've met a lot of things with love by choice that have caused me so much anxiety and fear, because I felt vulnerable, I felt something else, and the only way past it has been an intense finding, hard finding, what am I grateful for, and disciplining myself to dig into that. And the other side is that I had to realize at one point, when we were going through our divorce, I was not okay if I lost certain things. That was not a good place to be. And I have to, and so it was an exercise to like, am I okay losing everything? Am I okay if everything changes? Or am I gonna drink? Or am I gonna kill myself? Or am I gonna do, you know, very real things. How do I be at a place where I'm okay if everything were changed tomorrow, if everything were gone tomorrow? If I'm really living there with that gratitude piece, I'm doing well. And there's been a lot of days that I've been living with anxiety lately, and I've had to exercise this. I'm not saying I'm great at it. But, and so I don't know if there's a way to finally escape it forever, but sometimes it's respect instead of fear. And I respect the fact that all this could be gone tomorrow, because it has been for me. It's been all gone. And I had to learn to be okay. So, and I can't get away from the tears. But now tears too, for me, are a part of the acceptance of life, that thank God I get to feel on all levels of engagement without falling apart and being a piece of crap for it. Thank God I get to feel. It doesn't disintegrate my day and ruin my life that I have to feel. It used to, because that was a whole nother fear anyway.
I mean, we have time for maybe one more question, a short one, if anyone does have one. No? All right, cool. Thank you, guys. That was a phenomenal panel. I really, really appreciated it. So, thank you all for attending the panel. At this time, we will circle up for a prayer of one of you guys' choosings, or...